So good evening. Just to mention before we begin the shiur this evening, next week we will not be having a shiur due to Hanukkah, people's various commitments and engagements. Torah study remains recommended on Hanukkah by rabbis everywhere, but our shiur will continue Mitz Hashem in 2 weeks' time, which will be Monday, January the 6th. And for this evening, of course, Hanukkah is just a couple of days away. We wanted to devote our remarks to the festival of Hanukkah. And as we often do, to begin with a matter of halacha or minhag, and then move on to other related things. And the topic that I wanted to speak about this evening is one that we're certainly familiar with it practically as a feature or as a fixture of the Hanukkah lights. But as we'll see, there's quite a bit to say about it. And that is the shamash. Of course, we focus on the lights, how many, going up, and for each person, and so on, mahadrin, mina mahadrin. And alongside all of this, we have this other light, which is called the shamash. And as we'll see, not only is there a lot to say about the shamash, but actually one needs to clarify which light we actually are referring to when we use the term shamash. As we'll see, there is perhaps more than one meaning of this term. But what is the background to all of this? The source of the idea of what we call a shamash, that is to say, an extra light in the menorah, is with Ashkenazi Rishonim. The Mordechai, who is a contemporary of the Rosh, so this is the 1200s. And it's really Ashkenazi Rishonim, I think for reasons that we'll see. And the Tor cites this, it's adopted by the Shulchan Aruch. But it begins with the Torah citing these Ashkenazi sources. And the background is, as we know, Hanukkah lights are not there to be benefited from. One is not actually allowed to use their light for any purposes, even mitzvah purposes. As we say, Ein lanu rishus lishtamesh bahem, we don't have permission to use them, ela lo osam bilvad, only to see them. The reason for this is itself a subject of discussion. Some say that it's because of the concept of bizui mitzvah. It's degrading for a mitzvah to be used for other purposes, in which case one would say even other mitzvah purposes. Every mitzvah should have its own space. Perhaps it is a mitzvah issue, bizui mitzvah, degradation of a mitzvah to use it. Others say, the Ran and others, that this is part of the Zecher LaMikdash. As we know, much of what goes towards the Hanukkah lights is a replication or commemoration of how it was done in the Beis HaMikdash. That's why we need to have a wick and fuel of sorts, either oil or at least wax, which is congealed fuel in a container. And one of the aspects of Zecher LaMikdash, of the menorah as it was in the Mikdash, is that it was Kodesh. And as befits Kodesh, it shouldn't be used for other purposes. And this seems to be the reading, as we go back to Haneris Halalu, we say on all of the 8 days of Hanukkah, Haneris Halalu Kodesh. We proceed, or preface by saying that they're Kodesh, and then say, Ve'ein lanu rishus lishtamesh bahem. And Rav Shlomo HaKohen of Vilna, in the Tshuvas Binyan Shlomo, says that we preface by calling them Kodesh, because that is the reason why Ein lanu rishus lishtamesh bahem. As a Zecher LaMikdash, to give them a commemorative status of Kodesh, not to be used for other purposes. Now, the original mitzvah of Hanukkah lights is that they should be by the doorway to the house, which actually is a place that a person typically doesn't need light. If you're inside, there by the door, and it's not so much an issue. However, as we know, the Gemara itself says that in what's called a time of sakana, a time of danger, and danger needs to be defined, a person lights inside. You put it on your table, manicha al shochano vidayo. In Ashkenazi countries, there became a widespread minhag to light inside. It was considered dangerous, and whether the danger is to the people who are lighting or to the Hanukkah lights themselves, acts of vandalism or stealing menorahs or whatever. And therefore, there arose the practice, which became very widespread, to light inside. That remains a minhag. One could argue that perhaps one could light outside again, and some people do, but others continue to light inside. But if you bring the menorah inside, then that is a place that you would need light, that you could conceivably use it for light. It's in your house. And this is the background for the extra light, the way the Torah explains it, that if a person should come to benefit or to use the lights of the menorah, there should be an extra light. So that is the light that he is benefiting from, not the Hanukkah lights. That is the origins of the extra light. It's there for usage because the Hanukkah lights are not there for usage. Now, this actually gives rise to a very interesting practical question. Namely, if we say the extra light, and let's call it the shamash for now, if we say the extra light is there in order that if you need to use light, that's what you use, so do you need specifically to use the light of the extra light? Or is it sufficient for these purposes that as long as there's a non-Hanukkah light there, which could provide sufficient illumination, so then it's no longer such an issue, even if the actual illumination may be coming from the menorah as a whole? It's difficult to envisage, for example, on the eighth night of Hanukkah, when you have eight Hanukkah lights and one shamash, so it's outnumbered 8 to 1 in terms of the illumination that's provided. Could one feasibly or realistically say that you're getting benefit purely or even primarily from that extra light? So some say at least it should be the light that is closest to your usage, and others say it's enough that there's an extra light there that could in principle give you the illumination. Although this is a very speculative question, I think it would have major ramifications for where the extra light should be. If we adopt the first approach, that you really should have this as the light closest to whatever usage you may have or you may need, then the extra light would need to be at one of the sides of the menorah, and you would use the light at that side. If the shamash is in the middle of the menorah, there's no way that you can conceivably say I'm using the light of the shamash as opposed to any of the other lights. So for the first approach, the shamash would need to be at the side, and indeed, many menorahs have the shamash at the side. However, other menorahs have the extra light in the middle. You have 4 on one side, 4 on the other, and in the middle, somewhat elevated, you have the shamash. That's problematic if you need to use its light. It's literally in the middle of all the Hanukkah lights. But if we take the second, so to speak, more lenient approach, that it's enough that there is an extra light there that could be used, and that makes the whole affair permissible, then a shamash in the middle of the menorah would also be okay. So if your menorah has a shamash in the middle, no need to replace it. There's plenty to rely on there. But either way, what is important is that the extra light, and this is emphasized by the Shulchan Aruch, the extra light should not be placed in a similar arrangement to the other Hanukkah lights, for the simple reason that we place much emphasis on the number of lights, especially if it's Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin, on the second night 2 lights, on the third night 3 lights. And therefore, if there's another light, it could be confusing because is this the extra light or is this already another day? In order to avoid any such confusion, and it should be recognizable that the number of Hanukkah lights represent the days, the extra light is somehow distinct from them. It could be distinct from them indeed the Mordechai himself, who's one of the fathers of this minhag in terms of recording it, says that the shamash should actually be a larger light than the others. But even if it isn't larger, it should be set aside from them, or perhaps more elevated, or even some say it can be lower than them, just not in the same row, so that it should be completely recognizable without in any ambiguity as to which lights represent what night of Hanukkah it is. So as we say, the extra light begins with Ashkenazi Rishonim. It is adopted by the Shulchan Aruch. And still, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, you'll see there is a Sephardi and Ashkenazi version of this minhag. The Shulchan Aruch records it, and this is in Tafresh Ayin Gimel, as we said, light and extra light. It should be a certain distance away or higher, etc., but light and extra light. But the Ramah says no. The minhag that he records, which I'm not sure how many people do this, but the minhag that the Ramah records is not that you light an extra light, which means, for example, on the third night of Hanukkah, it's not that you light three and then another one, which is there to be lit. Rather, says the Ramah, you take the candle that you've been using to light the three lights, and that is the shamash. And when you finished lighting your three lights on the first night, then you affix that shamash that you used to light those lights, you put it next to them, and that is your shamash. And the Ramah says the reason this is better is because you're not even lighting four lights. You're only lighting three. And then the lighter is put next to them. But what's interesting is, with this, the Ramah introduces us to the question with which we began, namely, what is the shamash and why is it called the shamash? And here we see there are actually two possibilities. According to the Ramah, the reason why it's called the shamash is because shamash means to use, and it has been used. It's been used to light the Hanukkah lights. And then you place it as the extra light. Whereas according to the Shulchan Aruch, if you light an extra light from the outset, and that extra light is called the shamash because you can be mishtamesh le'oro, you can use its light. And what that means is that for many of us, we actually have two shamashes. We'd call them both shamash, but for different reasons. The candle that we use to light the lights is itself called the shamash. And if you light the extra one, which is somewhat more elevated, if you have an oil menorah, it's not so easy to use that to light the others. So it itself is lit. And that's also called the shamash, because it's there, lishtamash le'oro, if necessary, should the situation arise. What's important to note, in conclusion with regards to this, is that the minhag of the shamash is what you could call a pure minhag, meaning for a number of reasons, as the poskim describe, Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach and others, the original reason to necessitate the extra light can be argued is no longer there for one of two reasons. Firstly, as we mentioned in preface, in principle, if you light the lights where they should be lit ideally, which is by the entrance to the door, so then that's not a place where you typically would need to use the light. A person should be able to find his way into his house even without a menorah there, which means that in a location where you wouldn't need the light, there is no necessity for an extra candle to use for its light. And still we have the extra candle, even though it's the light by the doorway, because that's the minhag. Additionally, says Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach, in our time, where we have electric lights. And the difference between electric lights is the Gemara itself says, if you light inside, there should be another candle in the room. And still there arose the minhag of the shamash, because maybe that's on the other side of the room, but you need illumination in the menorah side of the room. But an electric light basically deals with the whole room. So as soon as you turn on the light, there will never be a requirement that you would need the light of the menorah to use for its light. Once again, therefore, the reason for the extra light is no longer there in the times of electricity. And still, we light the extra light. No one will not light the shamash. Why? Because that's the minhag. So it turns out that when we appreciate the background to the extra light, to the shamash, we understand that currently it exists with the menorah as a matter of minhag, I would say it has a place of honor, a time-honored place within the menorah, much beloved and well-deserved. And it's there purely attesting to the power of minhag. There is one final comment with regards to the shamash. We say that it's there should you need to use the menorah. This is the light you should use. The Be'er Heitev, one of the great poskim, which is actually published in this or printed on the same page as the Mishnah Berurah. The Mishnah Berurah made a point of including two classic halachic compendiums or compendia in the Mishnah Berurah, and one of them is the Be'er Heitev. And he says that even should you need to use the extra light, again, back in the day where that was feasible, it shouldn't be what he calls a tashmish maguna, a degrading use, which I guess would be to clean dirt off shoes or something like that. It should be a mechubadika use, which is very interesting. Because what that tells us is that the shamash is not kodesh. It is overtly not kodesh. It is for that very reason that we have it in the menorah, so that it shouldn't be kodesh. The lights themselves are kodesh and you can't use them for anything. The shamash is chol. And yet, lo and behold, this chol light, which was there and attached to be used, but having become attached to the menorah, it itself has attained a somewhat elevated status. You can use it, but don't use a chol item attached to the menorah for a degrading purpose. Use it for something mechubad. And if possible, one could say that itself is an enduring message, especially as Chanukah deals with matters of kodesh and chol. It's very much in the world of chol. But what a lesson from the shamash, if not the fact that even chol can be elevated by being attached to kodesh and with all of the implications thereof. So these are some of the, dare I use the term, highlights with regards to the shamash. And from there, let us move on to other matters pertaining to Chanukah. Something that is emphasized in all of our liturgy and all of our tfilos with regards to Chanukah is the role of the Kohanim within the story. Thus, for example, as we light the menorah, we say the paragraph Haneiros Halalu, which is sourced in antiquity. It's in Maseches Sofrim. And as we know, Haneiros Halalu Anu Madlikim, for all the miracles that were done, Hanisim Levosh Yasis Lavasinu, Ayidei Kohanecha HaKadoshim. We emphasize that these miracles were performed through the agency of your holy Kohanim. Ayidei Kohanecha HaKadoshim. Likewise, in Alanisim, which is also sourced back to the Gemara, we begin Bimei Matisyahu ben Yochanan, Kohen Gadol. We make a point of stating he was a Kohen Gadol. And that seems to be something that we wish to state explicitly and to pay attention to, because the miracle really was done through Kohanim. In fact, this recognition receives a further expression according to some minhagim. The Kriyas HaTorah for the mornings of Chanukah is from Parshas Noso. It's the well-known Chanukah Samishkan. It's the korbanos that they brought in the inaugural days of the Mishkan. They had 12. We can pack those 12 into 8. And that is Perek Zion of Chumash Bamidbar. And indeed, the Ashkenazi Minag, in principle, is to start with those sacrifices, Chanukah Samishkan. However, just before the section of Chanukah Samishkan in Parshas Noso, there are the psukim of Birchas Kohanim. And the Shulchan Aruch says that on the first day of Chanukah, the laning should actually be pulled back and begin with the psukim of Birchas Kohanim before going on to describe the first day of Chanukah Hamishkan. And the reason why, once again, is in recognition of the role that the Kohanim played, the central and vital role in the story of Chanukah, Ayidei Kohanecha Kedoshim. So the laning starts with Birchas Kohanim. It is true, there is a side discussion with regards to the Kohanim, because they were the heroes of the Hanukkah story, and they were the ones that went out to war. When they achieved the victory to the extent that they did, they then assumed leadership and became kings. And that is something which famously drew criticism from the Ramban in Parshas Vayechi. He cites a number of sources which would seem to withhold the institution of kingship from the Kohanim. Their domain is the Beis HaMikdash, not the Melucha. Aside from his interpretation of Yaakov's words, Lo Yosef Shevet Mi Yehuda, which is to forbid anyone who's not from Yehuda from being a Kohen, which leads to questions of Shaul from Binyamin, etc. Either way, the Ramban is 100% effusive in his praise and admiration for the Chashmonaim as the instruments of the miracle of Hanukkah. But to take the subsequent step and assume the mantle of kingship, that is something that he is critical of them, and indeed he ascribes their downward spiral after a number of generations, not too many generations in fact, to the fact that they should never have been kings in the first place. It's interesting to note, however, that the Rambam, in the beginning of Hilchas Chanukah, and he tells the story of Chanukah, which itself is very interesting, as we've noted in the past, many people discuss this. The Rambam rarely gives us the background to the Chagim when it comes to Purim and all the others. He doesn't tell us the story of Purim, but when it comes to Chanukah, he does, gives us a brief description. And of course, every word is then poured over by the commentators. But the reason why the Rambam gives us the story of Chanukah is because of what he says in the introduction to the Mishnah Torah, namely that if you've read the Tanakh and you've read my Sefer, Mishnah Torah, you will basically know what a Jew needs to know, says Rambam. Well then, the Rambam assumes you've read the Tanakh, in which case you know the background to all of the Yomim Tovim, including Purim, for which we have Megillas Esther. But Chanukah is not described in the Tanakh, it's post-Tanakh, and therefore Rambam, true to his word, needs to provide you the background to the story, because between the Tanakh and the Mishnah Torah, you need everything that you need to know. And in the course of the Rambam's description of the miracle, he says, "Veheemidu melech min ha-Kohanim." They appointed a king from the Kohanim, and this is his description of the victory of Chanukah. And as Mefarshim point out, he does not seem to be critical of this. He seems to mention this as something which was part of how good things were, how wonderful the situation was, the Bechazor Malchus Yisrael, etc. And therefore, the Rambam doesn't seem to share the Ramban's position, critical position of the Chashmonaim for taking on Kahuna. If they deteriorated, it's for personal reasons, but not that it was a fatally flawed decision or move to take the Kahuna. Either way, that's with regards to the Kohanim taking on the Malchus, the kingship. But regardless, the miracle itself was the prime instruments with the Kohanim. And from a certain point of view, it's very easy to understand why. This was an ideological war. This was a spiritual war. Politically, we'd been under the oppression of Greece for many years, decades. But the cause for war, the causus bellum, was the religious oppression and the Kohanim, or the religious guides and leaders of the Jewish people, especially as so much of it focused on the breaching of the Beis HaMikdash and the defiling of the Beis HaMikdash, which is the territory of the Kohanim, and therefore they spearheaded the offensive against Greece. However, in addition to everything that we have said in the last few moments, highlighting and noting the crucial role of the Kohanim, we see that their position in this whole story goes beyond the fact that they're Kohanim. It derives more generally from the fact that they are Levim. And the reason why we say this is based on the bracha of Moshe to the tribe of Levi in Parshas Vezos HaBracha. As we know very well from Simchas Torah, Moshe gives a bracha to almost all the tribes, And when he gets to Levi, Lelevi Omar, Tumecha, Urecha, etc., at a certain point he says, Barech Hashem Chelo, may Hashem bless his host, Ufoal Yadav Tirtse, and may Hashem desire the work of his hands, of Levi's hands. And Rashi, citing the Medrash, says, this was Moshe presaging and referring to the work of Levi's hands in going to war against Yavan. Hashmonoi Ubanov, Moshe asks and blesses him in advance, may Hashem bless his host and desire the work of his hands. So this was a blessing that was given to the tribe of Levi as Levi. And this now leads us to the interesting question, what is the uniqueness of Shevet Levi as the antagonists and as the nemesis of Yavan? And the Medrash elsewhere also pits them one against the other. What does Levi have to do with Yavan as a tribe? I mean, Levi as a tribe. The four exiles, of which Yavan, Greece, is the third, are alluded to and depicted twice in Sefer Daniel. On one occasion, in a vision that was shown to Daniel himself, and on the other occasion, in a dream that was shown to Nebuchadnezzar. And we'll start with Daniel's vision. In Perek Zayin of Daniel, he has the vision where he sees the famous four beasts. And the third of those beasts, we're not going into all of them, each one it's its own discussion, but the third of those beasts is a leopard. And that, he is told, corresponds to the exile of Greece, the third exile. But what's a leopard got to do with Greece? Moving back in Sefer Daniel to chapter 2, and that's when Nebuchadnezzar has his dream, and no one can interpret it. Very reminiscent of Paro and Yosef in our parsha. And his dream takes the form of a statue, and the different parts of the statue are made of different materials. The head is of gold, and then the torso is of silver, and the trunk is of copper, and the legs are of other materials. And once again, these four materials, the four parts of that statue that is seen by Nebuchadnezzar, likewise correspond to the four exiles, which means the third material, gold, silver, and copper, the copper corresponds to Yavan. And here too we ask, Ma inyan copper etzel Yavan? What does the Nechoshes, why is that the metal that depicts the empire of Greece? And these questions are discussed by the Maharal in his Sefer on matters of Hanukkah, which is called Ner Mitzvah. And he explains as follows. The leopard to beasts and copper to metals actually share a common property. We know from our own Pirkei Avos experience that the leopard represents the trait of boldness or brazenness. As Yehuda ben Tema tells us, again, Minag Sfarad is to begin Shacharis with this statement every day. Heve az kanamer. He exhorts us to be bold as a leopard. So among the animals or the beasts, the namer, the leopard, embodies the trait of boldness. So too among the metals, Nechoshes is associated also with brazenness. We talk about brazenness as Azus Metzach, as we on Yom Kippur and elsewhere. Azus Metzach, the Navi Yirmiyahu, when he rebukes and upbraids the Jewish people for being brazen, he says to them, "Umetzchacha Nechusha." You have like a copper forehead. Azus Metzach. Nechusha, and the word nechush means kind of forthright. In that way, lahavdil, that's how we use the term in our parlance. And metzcha nechusha, copper to metals, also represents the trait of azus, of brazenness. And this brings us to Malchus Yavan. Yavan was not the first empire to try and expand their empires as far as they could. Wherein lies their brazenness? In their insistence that every single thing that one needs to know can be fathomed by the human intellect, and anything which can't is either non-existent or meaningless. So the entirety of life and the world, a person should be able, a wise man should be able to work it out all by himself. He doesn't need revealed wisdom. He doesn't need any assistance from on high. The seichel, human intellect, conquers all. Omnia vincit. And from a certain point of view, ein lecha azus gedola miso. I mean, to have such an approach, life with all of its mysteries and what is its meaning and how to explain everything, says Yavan, we've got it all worked out. And that's Azus. And therefore they impose that vision wherever they go and impose it on the revealed wisdom of the Torah. And the translation of the Torah into Greek is again an act of brazenness under the auspices of Talmai, the Egyptian Greek, because the conditions upon which it was done was for purposes of arbitration, as if to say, let's see what God has to say. And then we'll see what we have to say. And if it doesn't work out, we know who needs to go. The translation under those circumstances and under those conditions of the Torah into Greek is the translation of Judaism into Hellenism. But Yavan will always have the final word, arbitrating and outvoting even Hashem on high. Well, how does one fight such an enemy? The only way really, or the way that was certainly the appropriate way that was chosen, was to take the very same property, the very same quality of boldness, of azus, to reclaim it and to counter-use it, with that very trait, to go to war against Yavan. And what was the act of the Hashmonaim, if not an act of boldness, of the highest order? A handful of people, however many they were, a few dozens or whatever, against an imperial army. Ein lecha azus gedola mizo. I mean, that is boldness at its finest. Where did they get that from? All of this brings us back to Shevet Levi. The first time we see Levi in action, or as a protagonist in the Chumash, is when he is acting exactly in that way. Dina had been taken captive, hostage, by Shechem. She's being held there. And Shimon and Levi, together, they set out and they take care of the whole town. They were at that time, according to tradition, 13 and 12 years old, respectively. The pasuk says, "Vayikru Shimon veLevi, ish charbo." And the Mefarshim say, it says ish, because only one of them was an ish, only one of them is bar mitzvah. Shimon was bar mitzvah, Levi was 12 years old. And between the two of them, they took out the town and released their sister. It's important to note that Shimon and Levi's act of these two boys against a whole town to get their sister out, it had implications for the Hanukkah story, not only as a theoretical inspiration for the story. It was referenced as a trigger for the revolt in a work which is called Medrash Maisa Hanukkah. These terms, Medrash Hanukkah and Medrash Maisa Hanukkah, they're not Midrashim in the sense that we have them, but they are historical works and to be taken, you know, accordingly. But according to the Medrash Maisa Hanukkah, one of the sisters of the Hashmonaim brothers, she was getting married, and one of the terrible gezeiras of the Greeks was that whoever got married had to submit to a Greek officer before she could be with her husband. And on the night of her wedding, she exhorted her brothers, and she said to them, "Don't allow him to do this to me. Do not allow him to defile me in this way. Be like Shimon and Levi, she said to her brothers. Look what they did for their sister. And she exhorted them to do otherwise, to do likewise. And says the Medrash Maaseh Chanukah, that was one of the instigations of the war. They set out to find this officer who's expecting the bride. He didn't get the bride. He got her brothers, and they killed him. And that began the revolt in that part of the region. So it was overtly referenced and connected as the instigation of the of that part of the Chanukah story. But to go back to Shimon and Levi, the truth is, at the time, their act of boldness was criticized by Yaakov in what is known as the Brachos of Yaakov. And what does he say? Arur apam, cursed is their anger, ki az, for it is bold. What does Yaakov mean to say? And we should not forget, these are called brachos. But how is this a bracha? It is literally a curse. How is it a blessing? It's a blessing because Yaakov is imparting a message to those two brothers. Namely, you have a trait of boldness. It can be a great asset, but if it gets out of hand, if it's not controlled, it can be destructive. He felt that they acted not only in boldness, but also in anger in a way that was beyond what was required. And as we know, even back to Pirkei Avos, as much as Yehuda ben Tema says, Heve az kanamer, exhorts us to be bold as a leopard. The very next Mishnah, which I believe is also from him, says, az panim le gehenim. A person who's bold or bold of face is to gehenim. So are you telling the person to be bold or not? He should be bold in the positive sense, determined, forthright to do what's right. Az panim, that's already too much. It becomes his way of being, and is confrontational. That can itself become a very self-defeating thing and self-destructive. This is Yaakov's blessing to his sons. And why is it a blessing? Because he's alerting them to the potential benefits of their trait and the potential dangers. There is no greater blessing than to give a person that information. And indeed, much time passes from when Shimon and Levi receive that blessing or information from Yaakov. But the next time we see Levi in action, it is entirely praiseworthy. And that is at the time of the Chet HaEgel. Moshe comes down, people have gone astray, they're worshipping the eagle, dancing around the eagle, and Moshe raises his famous rallying call, Mi Lashem Eli, who is for Hashem, let him come to me. Vayasfu Elav Kol B'nei Levi. And Levi comes to him. And what does that mean? It means Levi got the message. Here is Levi. They're still using their trait. They would now need to dispense justice in a way that was very difficult, but it had to be done. Not in anger, but with determination. Shimon was absent from that gathering. And it seems that at this point, Shimon and Levi parted ways. Levi will respond. Shimon did not. Indeed, parenthetically, but it's important for the closing of the circle, so to speak. The next time we see a member of Shevet Levi acting with the trait of boldness is Pinchas. As he runs through Zimri and Cosby, in order to stop the plague. That also required great determination, and he was criticized for it, or not by the masses. And ironically and tragically, the one that he killed was a prince of Shimon. In other words, Shimon had used the trait of boldness actually in a destructive way. And he confronted Moshe and became Az Panim. So here's Levi, who in that regard had preserved the trait of boldness in its positive way and actually ended up using it to dispense justice against Shimon, his former partner in Shechem. That's how delicate and volatile and sensitive that trait is. But this now becomes the trait that's represented by Levi, and we can well understand why it is now that, in addition to everything about the Kohanim that would have them go to war, it's specifically as members of the tribe of Levi, they received a bracha from Moshe Rabbeinu, and significantly, Shimon did not receive a bracha from Moshe. That's a glaring absence with regards to this matter. And indeed, the next time we hear the words Mil Hashem Elai in our sources, they are Mil Hashem Elai words as uttered by Matisyahu when he kills that person who demanded that they offer a pig as a sacrifice for Avodah Zarah. He runs him through, raises up his sword, and says Mil Hashem Elai. That was originally said by Moshe, and Levi came to him, and now it's said by a member of Levi, and his family rallies round him, as do others from among the Jewish people who also resonate with that call and went out to war. And the rest is history. The rest is us. So this, I think, is a very important theme in terms of the ingredients of the events of the story of Hanukkah and the forces that were in play. And indeed, the message that endures Bayamim Mehim Bazman Azeh is that they succeeded by using constructively and correctly the trait of Azus, and sometimes you need it. Sometimes you need it against those for whom no other language really makes a difference. And then it is the stuff of which victory is made, with divine blessing as bestowed upon them by Moshe, Barech Hashem Chela. From here, I'd like to move to a medrash, which is an actual medrash cited by the Ramban back into our literature of Chazal. And it's cited by the Ramban in the beginning of Parshas Baal Osecha. This is the famous situation where Aaron was not involved in the Chanukas HaMishkan, but Hashem gave him the mitzvah of the menorah. And the medrash states, again cited by Ramban, HaKarbonos. When it comes to korbanos, so kol zman shebeis hamikdash kayam hei noagim. They are there as long as the beis hamikdash is there, but no longer. Aval haneiros la'olam ya'iru, but balosras haneiros will illuminate forever. And the Ramban raises the question. I mean, the neiros of the menorah and the mishkan also stop when the Beis HaMikdash stops. So what does the Medrash mean when it says that the Neiros illuminate forever? And that is why the Ramban says he sees within this consolation to Aaron, not the lighting of the menorah in the Mishkan or Beis HaMikdash, but rather the lighting of the menorah in Hanukkah, which would accompany the Jewish people for generations even after the Beis HaMikdash. That is the famous approach of Ramban. But as many Mefarshim point out, the matter seemingly remains difficult because the Medrash does seem to say that the light of the menorah will continue. Hanukkah is not the light of the menorah. It's a mitzvah. It commemorates a miracle. It uses a menorah, but it's not the light of the menorah. So in a sense, how have we really answered our question? If the question was that the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash also ceases once the Beis HaMikdash is no longer there, just like korbanos. Well, that remains true, and Hanukkah doesn't address that point. I mean, Hanukkah is a commemoration, but it doesn't seem to be a continuation. So what then does the Medrash mean, the lights of the menorah continue to illuminate? And indeed, the question is accentuated when we consider what was the role and contribution of the lights of the menorah. The Gemara famously says is Masechet Shabbos Daf Kaf Beis, and that's where the sugyas of Hanukkah are centered. Eidusi Labai Olam. The role of the menorah is its testimony for the world. Shashchina Shera BiYisrael, that the divine presence resides among the Jewish people. How so? Because, as we know, They put the same amount of oil, which is enough to last for a night. They put it in all seven branches of the menorah. And in six of them, at the end of the night, it was extinguished. But the middle branch, miraculously, kept on going until the next evening when it was time to light again. That miracle is testimony that the divine presence resides among the Jewish people. Once we know that, it becomes even more difficult to understand how our menorah is a continuation of the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash. Our oil does not miraculously last longer than it should, which means that everything that the menorah and the Beis HaMikdash did, our menorah doesn't do. So it's its own thing. It's a mitzvah, and it's with all the importance that that has, all the significance that that has. But it's not a continuation of the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash, which is the way the Medrash seemed to depict it. So the background to this question lies in a description of the Gemara in Maseches Yuma and Sanhedrin about the Anshei Knesset HaGadolo. We have tefillos. Our basic nusach of Shemona Esrei and Tefillos and Brachos is from the Anshei Knesset HaGadolo, the men of the Great Assembly at the beginning of the Second Commonwealth, the Second Beis HaMikdash. And in the first blessing of Shemona Esrei, so we say Hakel, HaGadol, HaGibor, VaHanora. All those three terms, HaGadol, HaGibor, VaHanora. And the Gemara says it was the Anshei Knesset HaGadolo who restored these terms. If you look in the works of Nevi'im, Yirmiyahu and Daniel, you will see that some of those terms go missing. Yirmiyahu says Hakel HaGadol HaGibor and doesn't say Hanorah. And Daniel misses out HaGibor. And the Gemara explains why, because they lived at times of exile or destruction, and it doesn't, you don't see that Hashem is mighty and awesome and his nation is being overcome and conquered and exiled. So they missed it out. Until the Anshei Knesset HaGadolo came, says the Gemara, and they restored those terms because they said no. Look at the Jewish people. Look at the survival of the Jewish people. Against all odds, and one need not elaborate. Do you not see the greatness of Hashem? Do you not see the awesome protective power of Hashem? There is no way in the world a people that pursued, that persecuted, could ever survive. And nations much greater than them have come and gone. World powers. Rav Hutner explains in the Pachad Yitzhak, why is it that these terms went missing from the prophets and were restored by the Anshei Knesset HaGadolo? Prophecy takes the form of visions. From a certain point of view, it needs to be visible on some level, and it isn't. The Anshei Knesset HaGadolo at the beginning of the Second Commonwealth represented, or they presided over, the transitional time from prophecy to post-prophecy. The last of the prophets were in their time. The last of the prophets were members of the Anshei Knesset HaGadolo, but it's understood that that era is coming to an end. And if you no longer have God-given prophecies with which to navigate the world and to understand things and to see things, what do you have? You have the God-given faculty of wisdom. And whereas it's difficult to see, but if you contemplate the situation of the Jewish people, and they're still there, and they survive all these things, survive and thrive. And think about it. You come to an apprehension, maybe not an apparition, but an apprehension of the greatness and the awesomeness of Hashem, and those terms come back. They may not have a role currently in the world of nevuah, of prophecy, but in the world of chokhmah that we transitioned into, they're back. And we say them every day. Hakel, HaGodol, HaGibor, VaHanora. This, of course, is very reminiscent of the famous words of Rabbi Yaakov Emden in his introduction to his commentary on the Siddur, where he states that upon reflection, the survival of the Jewish people is greater than any other miracle that's mentioned in the Chumash or in the Navi. And says Rabbi Yaakov Emden, And the longer things go, the longer Jewish history goes, the greater the miracle is. And he said that in the 1700s, and a lot happened between his time and now. What would we say? With this in mind, we come back to the question that we raised on the Ramban. Namely, the Medrash says that the light of the menorah will continue. And Ramban said, but it discontinues if there's no Beis HaMikdash. To which he answered, it continues in Hanukkah. But then commentators said, but that's not the light of the menorah, that's something else. The light of the menorah is lit as testimony that the divine presence resides among the Jewish people. It was based on a miracle. But what about our Hanukkah lights? They're just Hanukkah lights. So they're not a continuation of the role and function of the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash. But apparently they are. Because the Hanukkah lights that we light also attest to a miracle. And they also project the message and proclaim the message that the divine presence resides among the Jewish people. And should you ask, where is the miracle? Look at the oil. It lasts as long as it naturally should. There's no miracle in the oil in our menorah. So where is the miracle? The answer is, look at the person who's lighting the menorah. You're looking at a miracle. Look at the Jewish people who are still here, lighting the menorahs. There's your miracle. There is your testimony to the world that the divine presence resides among the Jewish people. If you're looking for the miracle of the Shekhinah Shor B'Yisrael, if we can borrow or paraphrase from Pirkei Avos, Al Tistakel B'Kankan, don't look at the container of the oil. Ela B'Misha Madlik Bo, look at the person lighting the oil. And then you'll see it. And what's so significant is that how do we come to this understanding? Through the Midah of Chochmah, through using our wisdom, our powers of reflection and contemplation. And when we do, we have this resounding conclusion that divine presence resides among the Jewish people. The very same faculty of wisdom that was used by Greece in order to supplant any notion of the divine is now used by the Jewish people every year to reinforce that the message of the presence of the divine. That is the reclaiming of the faculty of wisdom. Through Chachma, represented by the Anshei Knesset HaGadola, we say, Hakel HaGadol HaGibor V'Hanara. It's interesting that the mitzvah of Hanukkah lights, and certainly worth pondering, is of course always compared with its sister mitzvah of Purim. Hanukkah and Purim are very closely connected, sister festivals. But how different they are in this respect. The goal of Hanukkah lights is Pirsumei Nisa, just like reading the Megillah, but how different they are. On Purim, when we want to tell the story of Purim, we tell it in detail. I mean, we literally read Agantz Megillah, and no detail is spared. And publicize the miracle through telling the story in all of its details. When it comes to Hanukkah, we don't tell the story. We light the menorah. And that's it. I think it's safe to say if a person didn't know the story of Hanukkah before he sees a menorah, he's not going to work it out by looking at a menorah. I mean, that's a lot to ask from a person. So why is it that we don't tell the story? Okay, it's not in the Tanakh, the Seder, but say something. Perhaps the reason why we light the menorah, and that's it. And if you know the story, you know the story. But we don't go into the story because the Hanukkah lights, they begin with that story of Hanukkah, but they're not restricted to it. Really, what you're proclaiming. When you light the lights, wherever they are, in your house, by your door, in your window, you are proclaiming Shashchina Sherer B'Yisrael. And every generation has its own story. It begins with the story of Hanukkah. But it doesn't end there. The Lashon of the Rambam is very interesting. In the end of Hilchos Chanukah, this is in Perek Dalet, Halacha Yud Beis, and he says, Mitzvah Ner Chanukah, Mitzvah Chaviva Hi Ad Ma'od. Chanukah lights is an especially beloved mitzvah. V'tzarech Adam Lizaer Ba. A person should be very careful with this mitzvah. And now, hear the words of the Rambam. Kedei Lehodia Hanes, to proclaim the miracle, Ulehosif B'Shevach HaKel V'Hodo Alo, and to add praise and thanks to Hashem al hanisim sha'asalon, for the miracles that he did. The Rambam begins by saying the goal of the mitzvah is lehodia hanes, to proclaim the miracle, and then to add praise and thanksgiving to Hashem for the miracles that he did. Is this all one thing? The Rambam seems to have split it up into two. The Rambam could very simply have said, the mitzvah of Chanukah is to proclaim and to add praise and to thank Hashem for the miracles. But he says Chanukah is to proclaim the miracle and to add praise and thanks for the miracles that he did. And could it be that what the Rambam is alluding to is that the praise that we add is beyond the story of Chanukah? Because Chanukah gives us the message, but that message has been expressed in so many different ways. And so many other kindnesses, and so many other miracles. Every iteration in every era where the Jewish people have survived is another miracle, for which Hashem should be praised and thanked for. So it begins with Chanukah, but it doesn't end there. And indeed, the Rambam elsewhere, in Sefer Ahava, in Hilchos Tefillah, at the end of Hilchos Tefillah, he actually has a text of the Seder HaTfilos, which of course is, again, every word is pondered and poured over. And in his Nusach for Al HaNisim, and the Shulchan Aruch cites this as something that some people say, and it concludes, Keshem She'asiso Emahem Nisim Gevuros, we say to Hashem, just like you did with them, miracles and mighty deeds, Kain asei imanu nisim gvuros. So to do for us, ba'esuv on hazos, at this time. So, Chanukah, in some respects, of course, to a certain degree, all festivals, but certainly in this regard, Chanukah especially so, it's a time where we look backwards, but then we bring it forwards. Because the message that was given of the menorah is still there. It continues in our Chanukah. And you have hundreds of thousands and millions of miracles will be lighting the menorah in 2 days' time. And they are all attesting to the fact, each one in their own way, Shashchina Sherer B'Yisrael, the Divine Presence resides among the Jewish people. And this is a message that we hope to carry with us, and we hope in the merit of the Chanukah lights and all the other things that we are doing, that as each person adds their illumination and their own testimony, Shashchina Sherer B'Yisrael, it should come back and exist and be manifest for all, not only in the realm of Chachma, but once again, in all to see V'ro, Ayin Ba'ayin, B'Shuv Hashem Tzion, V'yoma Kol Hashem Neshama Ba'apo, Hashem Elokei Yisrael Melech, U'malchuso Ba'kal Mashallah, we shall see the fulfillment, the full fulfillment, Bayamim Ein Bazman Hazeh, B'Meheir B'Yamin, Lichtige Chanukah to all.